Greetings. My name is Stan Prager from the ReGARP book blog, www.regarp.com. Today's podcast features my review of The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War by Michael Gora. For every Southern boy 14 years old, not once, but whenever he wants it, there is the instant when it's still not yet 2 o'clock on that July afternoon in 1863. The brigades are in position behind the rail fence. The guns are laid and ready in the woods, and the furled flags are already loosened to break out, and Pickett himself, with his long oiled ringlets and his hat in one hand, probably, and his sword in the other, looking up the hill, waiting for Longstreet to give the word, and it's all in the balance. No, that is not a snippet plucked from a Shelby Foote anecdote delivered with mellifluous voice in his signature cadence on the Ken Burns docuseries The Civil War, but a passage from William Faulkner's 1948 novel Intruder in the Dust. Foote, writer and raconteur, who masqueraded as historian, is celebrated as much in some circles for his three-volume narrative history of the Civil War as he is by a much wider audience for his extensive on-camera commentary on the docuseries that articulates the Southern perspective in thinly disguised lost cause soundbites that deftly excise slavery from any conversation about the war. Faulkner also was no historian, nor did he pretend to be, but he certainly understood that slavery was the central cause of the war, as well as its tragic aftermath for the denizens of the South, for blacks as well as for whites, even if he had difficulty saying that out loud, although we do hear it loud and clear through his carefully crafted characters in the drama and poetry that decorated the prose of his magnificent fiction. Slavery and its Jim Crow offspring poisoned the South, and the toxin was no less potent in Faulkner's day than it was on that July afternoon in 1863. The excerpt above references the moment just prior to the doomed Confederate assault known as Pickett's Charge on the third and final day of the Battle of Gettysburg, seen by many then and now as the turning point of the Civil War, although careful students of the conflict would tell you that another far more consequential Union victory, the fall of Vicksburg, which cut the Confederacy in half, took place just one day later, more than 1,000 miles distant in Faulkner's native Mississippi. Faulkner aficionados gleaned that too, not least because its significance is subtly underlined in the short story Ambuscade, that later serves as the opening installment of The Unvanquished. When Colonel Sartoris's young son Bayard and his enslaved companion Ringo eavesdrop on the colonel's revelation that Vicksburg is gone, just as the family silver, packed in a trunk, is shuttled out to be buried in the orchard. But the point here, for the purposes of Faulkner's fiction, as well as the real-life tragedy of the South that still prevails today, well beyond the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, is that the what-if of the war's outcome persistently echoes across far too much of the Southern landscape in 2024. If not as loudly as it did in 1865, or in 1862, the year of Faulkner's death, it yet remains all too perceptible, socioeconomically and politically. Nothing ever spoke to that phenomenon better than a more famous Faulkner quotation found in another novel, Requiem for a Nun. The past is never dead. It's not even past. And possibly nothing proves its endurance better than the fact that this election year has seen at once bans against teaching about slavery and race in some Southern states and, more remarkably, pro-secession candidates vying for office in Texas, perhaps grown men still fantasizing about that instant when it's still not yet 2 o'clock on that July afternoon in 1863. The past and present together underscore the relevance of The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War, a brilliant and extremely well-written blend of history, biography, literary criticism, and travel writing by Michael Gora, professor of literature at Smith College. After years of reading, studying, and teaching Faulkner, Gora decided to take it to the next level, and he set out to visit the various geographies where Faulkner walked the earth, battlefields where Southern blood was shed, and the likely environs of the fictional characters, Compsons, Sutpins, Snopes, and a host of memorable African Americans, that inhabited the author's imaginary Yaknapatawpha County. Had he stopped there, the end result might have been another academic biography peppered with literary analysis. But instead, Gora, who correctly identifies the Civil War and its repercussions as existential to Faulkner's literary themes, assigned himself a rigorous self-study of the war and its wider implications. In the process, the author discovered what today's historians have long recognized, that there was and remains more than one war. The actual war as it occurred, with all of its ramifications, and the way the war is remembered, especially in the South. There are multiple versions of the latter, both conflicting and overlapping, informed at once by truth and by imagination. The most twisted and most stubborn of these is known as the myth of the lost cause, that has the South waging a righteous, if hopeless, quest for liberty against a rapacious North intent on domination. Eventually, the heroic South is overwhelmed by sheer numbers of men and materiel and goes down to an honorable defeat, only to fall victim to Northern plunderers in the Reconstruction days that follow. Here it is solely a white man's war, brother against brother, forged by incompatible forces arrayed in opposition, states' rights versus federalism, agriculture versus industry, rural versus urban, free trade versus tariffs. In this version, slavery is almost beside the point, and blacks are essentially expunged from history. African Americans appear in cameo roles when they show up at all, as harmless servants in the South's peculiar institution, which is presented as something benign, even benevolent, that would have simply faded away on its own had Lincoln not launched what is still known in some circles as the War of Northern Aggression. More recently, blacks make an awkward reappearance in some odd strands of Lost Cause, now recast as comprising legions of imaginary uniformed black Confederates who eagerly stand guard with their masters to defend Southern sovereignty. Otherwise, blacks disappear almost without a trace. Gone are the millions held in chattel slavery, the half million that self-emancipated by fleeing to Union lines, the nearly 200,000 that fought for Union in the United States colored troops, and most thoroughly erased are the many, many thousands of camp slaves that accompanied Confederate armies throughout the war, including Lee's infantry at Gettysburg, a fact likely unknown to that 14-year-old dreaming of Southern victory. The Lost Cause is a vile lie, but like all effective lies, it is infused with elements of truth. Of course, slavery was not the only cause of the Civil War, just 95% of it. The key is to focus on the other 5%. And that effort was so successful that this fictitious story became America's story. So successful that the United States became the only nation in the world to host hundreds of monuments to traitors and rebels across its landscape, many that still preside over public squares today. So successful that it was integrated into the historiography that dominated American education for a century to follow. And ingredients of that distorted curriculum even touched me, growing up in New England in the 1960s. Dramatically reinforced on our family's console TV as the networks commonly replayed Gone with the Wind, the histrionic paean to Lost Cause, an endless loop of the hapless enslaved Prissy incongruously shrieking, "The Yankees is coming," in terror rather than celebration. I was a Connecticut boy, a state that saw thousands of lives sacrificed in the cause of Union, but I pretended to be a Confederate soldier when I played war. So deeply sympathetic was I to the Southern cause. There was only one black child in my elementary school, so I did not find it odd that blacks made few appearances in my textbooks. But I was a voracious reader, even as a young teen, and books shaped me. I read deeply in American history, fell in love with the Civil War era, and began to discover that what I learned in school was not only superficial, but woefully incomplete and conspicuously misleading. I also read a good deal of fiction in those days, across multiple genres. I think I was 15 when I discovered Faulkner, and the first novel I read is one of his most challenging to follow or comprehend, The Sound and the Fury. The first section consists of nearly 60 pages propelled solely by a vehicle manufactured from disjointed bits of the stream of consciousness of Benji Compson, a severely intellectually disabled adult, tagged as an idiot in Faulkner's day, who experiences time as directionless in an interior monologue that speeds along a twisting road of sharp turns from 1928 to 1912 to 1902 and swerves back again repeatedly, with no signs or guardrails to assist the reader, a marvelous journey motif in nonlinear time instead of distance. I found myself reading and rereading paragraphs and pages, again and again, often lost but relishing the long, strange trip, a dictionary habitually at my elbow as I struggled against an onslaught of vocabulary both unfamiliar and intimidating. I loved every minute of it. And in that early 1970s acid-infused era, Faulkner's style here, verging on the phantasmagoric, seemed the perfect companion to the likes of Jefferson Airplane and Pink Floyd. In my teens, I did not connect Faulkner to the Civil War, but literature and history were then, and today remain, my two great passions. I would read many more Faulkner novels and short stories in the years to come, and my fascination with the Civil War was part of my motivation, decades later, to return to school to obtain a master's degree in history. By then, the connection between Faulknerian themes and the tortured legacy of the war was apparent. But it was not until I read The Saddest Words that I came to understand how inextricable that link truly was. Faulkner, and Foote for that matter, grew up indoctrinated in a version of Lost Cause more virulent than that which touched my northern classroom, a memory of the war and Reconstruction so far removed from reality that it amounted to a greater fiction than any of Faulkner's novels. A fairy tale mandatory to explain to later generations why the weird world they inhabited existed as it did, lest they be crushed by cognitive dissonance. But, as Gora detects in his superb analysis, it is Faulkner's characters who speak the truth, even if the living, breathing William Faulkner could not articulate those contradictions. The violence, the rape, the incest, the guilt, the despair that are part and parcel of the body of Faulkner's works are a kind of subliminal confession that the author is well aware of the actual horror that disfigures Southern life, that real life pretends away. His white protagonist voiced this. His black characters, who speak in dialect now judged offensive, bear authentic witness in what is left unsaid. In The Sound and the Fury and its cousin, the even more daunting Absalom Absalom, Faulkner dwells upon miscegenation, a term anachronistic today that once served in the white South as an epithet for race mixing. Gore notes that the neologism itself only dates to 1863, and I recall it still wielded as a cudgel in Dixiecrat rhetoric in the 1960s, although it certainly reflected a fear deeply rooted in the antebellum. But what could never be uttered aloud in the South was that the kind of race mixing deemed revolting was strictly limited to that which might occur consensually between a white woman and a black man. Because the reality was that the institution of slavery sponsored a vast mixing of the races, but that was primarily the product of the white men of the planter aristocracy, coupling with black girls and black women, held as chattel property, and was almost always non-consensual. They preached against a dread of racial amalgamation while essentially engineering it. The enslaved population on any given plantation frequently included those who were children of those who owned and worked them. There were contemporary observations at Monticello that among the enslaved were light-skinned blacks with red hair and freckles who bore more than a passing resemblance to Jefferson. Gore cites the familiar observation from Southern diarist Mary Chestnut that the mulattoes one sees in every family resemble the white children. Any lady is ready to tell you who is the father of all the mulatto children in everybody's household but her own. Those, she seems to think, drop from the clouds. Of course, we now know that none of this is strictly hypothetical. Genome-wide analysis reveals that the DNA of African Americans contains, on average, about 25% European ancestry. We can make an educated guess that there are few traces of consent in those numbers. Blacks and whites were always together in those days, although in clearly defined roles. Gore refers to an episode in The Sound and the Fury when Harvard-bound Quentin Compson has cause to reflect on race when he sits next to a black man on a bus in 1910, something that was common to the North then, but taboo in Jim Crow Mississippi. But that was not always the case. Segregation was invented in the North. At one time, free Boston blacks, subject to discrimination on rail travel, while hardly envying their enslaved brethren, marveled that Southern railroads did not separate the races. Massachusetts finally desegregated rail cars in the 1840s. It was not until the 1880s that segregation was characteristic to Southern life, and that was only obtained by the failure of Reconstruction and the rise of redemption. No longer enslaved, blacks were terrorized and murdered as former Confederate officers and officials returned to power and cowed the Southern black population into second-class status, stripped of rights granted by the 14th and 15th Amendments, while the rest of the nation collectively averted its eyes. This is, by the way, not ancient history. I was 7 years old when Congress passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964. The past is never dead. It's not even past. Of course, separate but equal always translated into separate and unequal, but Southern whites and blacks could not ever really be separate, and that's the rub. Faulkner saw that through the eyes of his white characters, who lived in terror of incest and race mixing, only to turn around and see a world outlined inescapably by these implications. It is likely that the enslaved Sally Hemings, who bore Jefferson several children, was the half-sister of his late wife Martha. It is said Foote and Faulkner met, and even developed a sort of friendship. Foote was a stubborn defender of Southern culture. Deep down, many of Faulkner's characters seemed to hate the South. I can't help but wonder if the two ever talked about that. The Sound and the Fury's Quentin Compson was certainly consumed by it, by the purity of Southern women, by the conundrum of race, by a devotion to honor, so much so that he discovers that he cannot leave the ill-fated South behind him even at Harvard, more than 1,000 miles from Mississippi, and in his anguish he takes his own life. But first, he conjures a memory of something his father once said to him. Every man is the arbiter of his own virtues, but let no man prescribe for another man's well-being, and I temporary, and he was. The saddest word of all, there is nothing else in the world. It's not despair until time, it's not even time until it was. Gora's synthesis of Faulkner's fiction, Civil War memory, and the echo of systematic racism that yet stains America is nothing short of superlative. That he achieves this while probing sometime arcane avenues of literature, history, and historiography, while ever maintaining the reader's interest, is especially impressive. If I was to find fault, it is only that towards the end of the volume, the author seems to drift away from the connective tissue in his thesis and wander off into what is clearly his first love, a detailed literary analysis of Faulkner's prose. But that is a quibble. And truth be told, I now feel inspired to turn to my own shelves and once more dig deeply into my Faulkner collection. In this arena, I must confess that Gora has truly humbled me. I have read The Sound and the Fury no less than 3 times, but his commentary on it makes it clear that I still did not entirely understand what Faulkner was trying to say after all. I suppose I must go back and get to know Benji again, one more time. Thank you for joining me for today's podcast. I encourage you to share it in your network. Many more reviews on an eclectic array of fiction and nonfiction books are available at regarp.com and regarpbookblogpod.com. Have a great day.